Good afternoon. My name is Jessica, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Listen Session Water Quality Standards Regulatory Changes Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you'd like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. As a reminder, today's conference call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to Grace Rovio. You may begin your conference.
Good afternoon. My name is Grace Rovio, and I'm located in EPA headquarters in Washington, D.C. I want to welcome you to this listening session for the general public on EPA's proposed rulemaking to revise the Water Quality Standards Regulation. We are at an early stage in this effort, and that's why we're holding these opportunities to gather your ideas. What we hear from you today is going to help us in formulating our proposal. There will be, however, other opportunities next year for more formal comments after we publish the details of our proposal in the Federal Register. As you'll learn in a few minutes, we've been taking a close look at EPA's regulation, which governs water quality standards, to see if we can improve its effectiveness in helping restore and maintain the integrity of the nation's waters. We have come up with a targeted set of changes to the regulation, and these were outlined in the Federal Register notice that announced these listening sessions. This is the start of the rulemaking effort that will result in a proposal in the Federal Register next summer. For the next 20 minutes, we'll be using the briefing document that was posted on the website to describe our thinking. If you have that briefing in front of you, we will lead you through it slide by slide, and we're currently on slide number one. If you don't have the briefing, that's also okay. We will cover the important points verbally, and then you can turn to the slides on our website for future reference. I'm now turning to slide number two. The main purpose of today is to solicit your views on the specific provisions that we're considering for this rulemaking. We'll be providing a short overview of our proposal and why we think changes in the regulation might be appropriate, but we really want to spend most of the call getting your feedback. On slide number three, we present our schedule. As you can see, we are in the early stages of the rulemaking. We haven't made any final decisions on the content of the proposal. Those decisions will be made after this call, as well as other ones that we are having with states and tribes. And after we publish our proposed rule in the summer of next year, there will be a formal 60-day public comment period. Now I'm going to turn to Christina Christensen to give you more information on the proposal.
Thank you, Grace. Slide four provides an outline of what I will be discussing today, and I'll begin with some background on what water quality standards are and why we're considering revising our National Water Quality Standards Regulation. I'll then give some more detail about each of the six areas we are considering for revision, which are listed on this slide. So turning to slide number five, what are water quality standards? Well, under the Clean Water Act, water quality standards are provisions of state, tribal, or federal law approved by EPA that describe the desired condition of a water body or the level of protection. Standards are the foundation for other programs of the Act, such as discharge permits, that impose enforceable water quality-based controls. Standards consist of three major components: designated uses, water quality criteria, and anti-degradation policies, and can include optional general policies such as variances and mixing zones. Slide number six shows that the Clean Water Act gives states and authorized tribes the primary role to set standards. Authorized tribes are federally recognized Indian tribes that EPA has found eligible to run standards programs. This is known as Treatment in a Manner Similar to States, or TAS. As of today, 45 tribes have been approved for TAS. The Clean Water Act requires states and tribes to review their standards every 3 years. If they decide new or revised standards are needed, they must adopt these amendments and submit them to EPA for review. The Clean Water Act calls on EPA to review and approve standards within 60 days of submission, or disapprove within 90 days. If EPA approves the standards, they can then be used for all purposes under the Clean Water Act, such as setting permit limits or developing total maximum daily loads. The Clean Water Act also authorizes the EPA administrator to determine that federal water quality standards are needed to replace or augment state and tribal standards and to promulgate them as binding standards. Now let's consider the National Standards Regulation on slide number 7. The regulation simply adds detail to what the Clean Water Act says on designated uses, water quality criteria, and anti-degradation. It requires states and tribes to engage the public before revising their standards, and it specifies the roles of states, tribes, and EPA for administering standards. We're now on slide number 8. So why is EPA considering revising this regulation? Well, the main parts of EPA's regulation have been in place since 1983. They provided a solid foundation for controlling water quality. But there are some practical reasons for initiating this rulemaking. As we've implemented this 1983 regulation, some important issues have come up again and again that the regulation does not explicitly address. This can waste time and resources, and we'd like to try and improve that situation. Slide number 9 lists some of the work we did before settling on the specific areas we'd like to improve. In 2008, EPA developed a list of over 40 potential regulatory revisions that might help provide clarity and national consistency and lead to environmental improvements. In developing this list, we considered recurring policy issues as well as case law from the past 25 years. We also reviewed our 1998 advance notice of proposed rulemaking and considered the comments that we received on it. In addition, we've held preliminary consultations with several state water quality standards managers and consulted with EPA regional experts to get a sense of where regulatory revisions were most needed. To narrow the field of over 40 potential revisions, EPA managers also considered how well the current regulation addressed recurring issues, whether it's equipped to handle emerging issues, and whether sufficient flexibility is provided to states and tribes when needed. Based on our review, we've narrowed our focus to 6 specific areas, and I will walk through each of them in sequence. Okay, turning to slide number 10, you see a list of the 6 targeted areas where we're considering revisions. Once I'm done going through these areas, we'll be asking you for your views. You might want to make a note of any comments you have as we go along and save them for the feedback part of this conference call. And of course, we welcome any of your views that support our ideas, but we're also interested in hearing your views on any possible unintended consequences of changing the regulation in a specific area. We also welcome any specific suggestions for changes that you do or do not wish to see in this proposal. Now let's turn to slide number 11 on anti-degradation. The current regulation sets a national policy of protecting existing uses and preventing the lowering of high water quality unless necessary to accommodate important economic or social development. The regulation also specifies that states and authorized tribes must adopt specific anti-degradation policies. All states and tribes have adopted policies in accordance with the regulation, and we do not see a need to change this. We are concerned, however, about implementation of these policies. Although many states have done a good job of implementation, some states have not even identified anti-degradation implementation methods, despite the regulation's requirement to do so. We recognize that the current regulation does not specify what the implementation methods must include, but only requires them to be consistent with the anti-degradation policy. So as possible changes, EPA is considering modifying the regulation to specify that anti-degradation implementation methods must meet specific minimum requirements. To do this, EPA is considering adding a paragraph that would specify minimum implementation elements to be included in a state or tribal standard. As an example, a minimum element could be a state or tribe's process for identifying high-quality waters. EPA is also considering requiring that anti-degradation implementation methods be adopted into state and tribal water quality standards rather than simply being identified. The methods would thus be subject to EPA for review and approval. Our current thinking is that these changes would bring more consistent application, clarity, and transparency to the protection of high quality waters. Further, EPA's oversight role would be more clearly defined. Our next area on slide 12 concerns the discretionary determination the EPA administrator can make that a revised or new standard is necessary to meet the requirements of the Act. This provision is in Section 303(c)(4)(b) of the Act. If such a determination is made, EPA must promptly propose a federal standard and promulgate a standard within 90 days of proposal. Over the years, there have been recurring instances of confusion or misunderstanding about what actually constitutes an EPA administrator's determination. So, for example, in some cases, EPA staff have sent routine letters suggesting priorities for states to consider when revising their water quality standards. Some courts have construed these types of communications to states as official EPA administrator determinations that oblige EPA to promulgate water quality standards. So EPA is considering clarifying in the Water Quality Standards Regulation that an administrator's determination must be signed by the administrator or someone he or she specifically authorizes and must include a statement that the document constitutes a determination under Section 303(c)(4)(b) of the Clean Water Act. EPA's current thinking is that this type of change could assure that it is clear when EPA has or has not made one of these determinations. And this kind of change would allow EPA to continue to provide routine written suggestions to states and tribes without triggering the need for an immediate federal action. On slide 13, we turn to the topic of designated uses. Section 101(a)(2) of the Act establishes a national goal that, wherever attainable, water quality must provide for the protection and propagation of fish, shellfish, and wildlife and recreation in and on the water. And if a state or tribe wants to remove one of these goal uses, the regulation requires it demonstrate that attaining the designated use is not feasible for one of six specific factors. They must also submit a use attainability analysis, a structured scientific assessment of factors affecting attainment of designated uses. The regulation does not, however, specify which uses, if any, must be adopted to replace the use that is being removed. Furthermore, EPA's longstanding interpretation of the Act and regulation is that Section 101(a)(2) uses are attainable unless the state or tribe demonstrates otherwise. This interpretation is central to our water quality standards program. However, it's not articulated explicitly in the regulation. So EPA is considering clarifying that designated uses reflecting the goals of the Clean Water Act are attainable unless otherwise demonstrated. States and authorized tribes must designate such uses unless they've conducted a use attainability analysis to support a lesser designated use, and EPA has approved that action. EPA is also considering clarifying that the highest attainable uses closest to the 101(a)(2) goal must be adopted if such a goal itself is not attainable. Okay, on slide 14, we'll discuss variances or temporary changes to water quality standards. Our current regulation allows states and authorized tribes to adopt variances as general policies for applying and implementing their water quality standards. This is specified in Section 131.13 of the regulation. We would retain the state and tribal discretion. But the current regulation does not provide any specificity on how to use variances. As a result, there is a lack of clarity on the proper use of variances. Furthermore, variances may often be repeatedly renewed without achieving environmental improvements in a water body. So EPA is considering establishing explicit provisions to guide the use of variances. So for example, EPA is considering a provision that requires all variances to have an expiration date. Such a change could provide regulatory clarity on what is an acceptable variance versus what is not. Slide number 15 addresses the reviews required every 3 years by the Clean Water Act, or triennial reviews. The current regulation does not call for involving the public when states and tribes determine what they will focus on in their reviews. This can have the effect of narrowing public input to those portions of standards that the state or tribe chooses to review. A second concern is that despite the availability of new scientific information, some states or tribes may not consider it in a timely fashion and thus may not always evaluate whether their current criteria continue to protect their designated uses. EPA is considering revising its requirements to specify that states and authorized tribes must solicit and consider public comments in determining the scope of each triennial review. EPA is also considering establishing a new triennial requirement that states and authorized tribes must evaluate whether their current water quality criteria continue to be protective of designated uses, taking into consideration any new information that has become available since the state or tribal criteria were adopted or last revised. This will clarify that states and tribes would need to consider EPA's most recent national recommended water quality criteria published under 304A. EPA's current thinking is that these changes will increase transparency by ensuring that stakeholders have input on the scope of triennial reviews. They could also strengthen oversight of whether state and tribal water quality criteria are being kept up to date and whether they continue to protect designated uses. Slide number 16 refers to three court decisions handed down since the regulation was last revised. The complete legal citations for these cases are in EPA's Federal Register notice. EPA is considering codifying the results of these decisions in the regulation. First, EPA is considering revising the definition of water quality standards that currently appears in the regulation to reflect the results of a 2004 court case concerning Florida's impaired waters rule. In this case, some binding provisions of state law had the effect of changing water quality standards without EPA approval. The court decision and EPA's response to it more clearly define which kinds of provisions actually constitute water quality standards requiring EPA review. Second, EPA is considering specifying that provisions which authorize compliance schedules are considered water quality standards and therefore must be submitted to EPA for review and approval. Compliance schedules govern the timing of water quality-based effluent limits and NPDES permits. This change would codify the results of a 1990 Environmental Appeals Board decision involving Starkist Carib Incorporated. Note that while authorizing provisions would be considered water quality standards, compliance schedules themselves are not. They are permitting provisions. Third, EPA is considering clarifying that states and authorized tribes must submit to EPA records of public participation that has occurred in reviewing and adopting standards. These records would include public comments and the state or tribe's responses to the comments. This change would codify the results of a 1996 decision involving standards affecting the city of Albuquerque. Codifying these three positions in regulation will help eliminate confusion and could minimize future litigation on these topics. This concludes our presentation of the proposal EPA is developing. Slide number 17 gives you several EPA websites for more information. They provide more information about these listening sessions and also about water quality standards in general. They also show you where we will be posting the transcripts and recordings of these sessions, and how you can provide your views in writing if you want to add to the views you've expressed today. Please note again that these are just listening sessions at a very early stage in the rulemaking process. There will still be a formal 60-day public comment period after the proposed rule is published in the summer of 2011. Thank you all for your attention, and I'll now turn the presentation back to Grace Robbio.
Thank you. We're going to now turn to the heart of the session, the feedback part of it. We're going to answer any clarifying questions first that you may have about anything that you heard so far. We're going to dedicate between 15 and 20 minutes to answering those kinds of questions, and then we're going to turn to answering any or taking comments on or views on the specific regulatory revisions that we're considering. We're going to be relying on the operator to help us through this process, so I'm now going to turn it to the operator to start that feedback session.
At this time, I'd like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your cell phone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Operator, are you there?
Yes. Your first question comes from Arthur Wolf, Prince of Shelby.
Hello? Hello?
Yes, you're on.
I have a general question I think would be instructive to everybody listening, or at least to me. When we talk about the Clean Water Act, does that also include and incorporate the regulations of the Safe Drinking Water Act? Are both of those involved in this discussion?
No. Today we are specifically talking about the Clean Water Act and particularly Section 131, which is the Water Quality Standards Regulation in the regulation.
So there's no study being done on the Safe Drinking Water Act, and your study has nothing to do with that. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. What if I have a situation of, at the same time, there's a problem that is affecting both of these, the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act, as I understand it? Who do I address that problem to? I'm sure they're both EPA, but whom specifically should I call them? We have a problem where there's some runoff that is contaminating a river and is contaminating an aquifer that provides a wonderful drinking water. The same project is doing both. How would you recommend that I address that, or to whom will you?
Yeah, I suggest, sir, that you email us at the shpdcomments@epa.gov address that appears on the last slide of this presentation, and we'll be happy to refer you to somebody in the drinking water program who may be able to help you.
Oh, that'll be on the last part of this program?
Yep, on the very last slide, there is an email address where you may send comments. You can send us a question there, and we will refer it on or get back to you.
Okay, and I haven't been able to pull that up. Could you please give me that email address now quickly?
Sure, I'll do it quickly, and then we'll move on. It's SHPD.
Please say again.
S as in Sam, H as in Harriet.
S as in Sam.
SHPD, comments, one word.
SAPD?
SH.
SH, like in Harry?
Yes.
Say S like in Sam, H like in Harry.
P as in Paul.
D as in Paul.
And D as in David.
D as in David.
Comments, one word.
Promise?
Comments, as in we're...
Oh, comments, excuse me.
That's okay.
All right.
And then at?
At?
EPA.
EPA.
.gov.
Is that the federal, that'd be the federal department,
the
EPA?
Yeah, that's the email address. We're going to receive comments on this particular rulemaking. And if you can send us a question there to referring to this conversation, we'll be able to help you.
Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Your next question comes from Michael Bloom.
To a number of states being consulted early on. I was wondering if a list of those contacts or states that were involved in those discussions could be made available on the website or at some point. And then also on the on slide 16, I was wondering if the specific court decisions, the dates or the dockets or some, reference number could be made available so that someone who wanted to look back at that particular court decision could do so.
Yes, thank you. Those are a couple of great clarifying questions. With regards to the list of participants from this session as well as from previous sessions, those will be made available on our website. And if you have the presentation in front of you, we identify the websites on slide 17.
Okay, but in terms of the number, the states, particularly the state water quality managers that were consulted, that even before this event, that would be instructive, I think, to see a list of those folks too.
Yeah, I think that both of the actual live feed from the session as well as the participants who logged in will be available, including the kind of the organization that they represent.
And then with regards to your second question on the court decisions, I can also direct you to the Federal Register notice that we put out announcing these public listening sessions, which I believe is you can also find that on our website. That Federal Register notice identifies the specific legal citation for those cases.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from John Ball.
Yeah. Okay, I'm from. My question is about the uses and the UAAs. I would like to know if there are clear sort of instructions as when some of the uses are not attainable, or they're conflicting uses for a water body, and therefore the agencies can do a UAA for those uses to be reconsidered. Are there clear instructions for that? And are there, because we haven't seen UAAs done for a long time. And there are clearly now some, I can give you an example. For example, in Los Angeles, we have man-made lakes which are filled with potable water. There is no input in terms of storm drain or output. They're filled with potable water. And the statewide policy is to use recycled water. And we're seeing now nutrient standards, nitrogen and phosphorus standards that we would see for a normal lake, you know, a soft bottom lake, applied to these man-made lakes, which get filled up with potable water. And those nitrogen standards are even lower than potable water. So it clearly asks for a revision of the use or somehow, you know, a UAA. And I wanted to know if there are some efforts in that area to clarify how a UAA, in what case it would be looked at and it would be approved.
Okay, it sounds like you are looking maybe for some general information and examples of UAAs that have been done in the past. And if you, I'll also direct you to slide 17 of our presentation. And we note that for further information about water quality standards under the Clean Water Act, we give you two websites to go visit. And on, I believe, the first website, you can actually link to some case studies we've developed, you know, situations where a UAA has been conducted for various reasons. And I think you might find some really helpful information on that site.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Next comment, please.
Your next question comes from Sharon Green.
Yes, my question also has to do with the page that has to do with uses. And I wanted to ask a clarifying question about under the bullet point of possible changes, number two, where a use specified in 101A2 is deemed unattainable, the highest attainable use closest to the goal must be adopted, that language. My question, I guess, is whether your current thinking is that there would also be an elaboration or definition of what the highest attainable use language means, because it's not always clear when you look at the variety of use designated uses, if you did remove, you know, one of the goal uses, what the, quote, highest attainable use would be.
Yes, thank you. That's a very good comment, and indeed it seems to have reoccurred between this call today and the previous sessions that we've had, the need for us to clarify what we mean by highest attainable use, and we will take note again of that and make sure that that's forthcoming. Thank you.
Your next question comes from Sally Shaver.
When you were talking about anti-degradation policy, you made the statement that it applied or that states needed to identify high-quality waters. Does anti-degradation only apply to high-quality waters?
The anti-degradation regulatory requirements currently describe the protection of existing uses as well as high-quality waters. I think it's fair to say, though, that the targeted revisions that we are proposing for you to consider here and give us comment on are really more are specific to enhancing the protection of high-quality waters, otherwise known as Tier 2 waters in the anti-degradation language.
Okay. Thank you.
It's a good question. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Your next question comes from Dave Piller.
Hi, this is Dave Piller out in Olympia, Washington. And the question I first want to ask has to do with your work on variances. I'm wondering if that will also include any language about mixing zones for NPDES permit discharges. Because as I understand it, the current regulation does not address the use of mixing zones.
Yes, that is correct. Our current regulation speaks very briefly, I think, to mixing zones. What we're considering doing for variances, I don't think we would be addressing mixing zones as part of that. I believe on our website we do have some information on mixing zones. We have a compendium of information on mixing zones that you might find useful, but not in this, not in the changes we're considering making to this regulation.
Okay. And one other comment or question I had was around I'll have to look back where you had my comment here. Was around the uses and protection uses and then updating where it talked about the states actually having to talk about whether or not their current uses and criteria were protective. And a lot of some states, at least, I believe, are still covered, including Washington State, under the National Toxics Rule adopted in 1991 or two, a long time ago. And, you know, they've never had to demonstrate that that particular rule is still protective of the uses in those states, including my state. And it seems like some kind of a link in the rule that you're addressing here back to the NTR specifically, I think, would be something that would be useful. I wondered if you're considering how to address the states that are still covered by the NTR.
I think that's a great comment, and thank you. We're going to make a note of that. I also just want to let everyone know that we have a room full of people here, and we're all taking notes on everything you're saying. So rest assured, we have your comments. And we're also recording as well.
Your next question comes from Ben Otto.
Hello, this is Ben Otto with the Idaho Conservation League. I just realized I think my question was answered. It was about the uses and whether the highest attainable, whether there would be some guidance about what highest attainable use means, if there's some sort of ranking system for the various uses. Sounds like you said you will offer that guidance at some point.
This is Manjali Vulcan talking. I did just want to clarify one thing, is that the concept of highest attainable use is not intended to indicate that there would be a ranking system between amongst the different uses, such as it's not about, you know, adopting aquatic life over recreation or another use over another. What we're talking about with high attainable use is the assumption that there is a spectrum of what is attainable for an aquatic life use, anywhere ranging from really, really bad aquatic life to a full 101A clean water expectation for aquatic life. And the concept of high sustainable use is really referring to where along that spectrum state standards are established at, state uses are established at. Thank you.
Very good. That is an interesting approach. And so I guess my question was just making sure that is promulgated in some sort of official way.
Yes, and we as Grace had said, we would clearly need to define it and expand on our thinking in the preamble as well.
Great, very good. Thank you.
Your next question comes from Brooks Smith.
I have a question of clarification. On page 16, you reference potentially revising the definition of water quality standards in response to litigation involving the Florida Impaired Waters Rule. That litigation was complicated. There's a long procedural history and a lengthy docket. And I am curious to confirm, as I understand it, in 2004, the 11th Circuit remanded an earlier district court decision back to the district court, who then asked EPA for a determination as to what might constitute or not constitute a water quality revision. In 2005, on July 6, 2005, EPA submitted that determination specifying what the agency believed to be interpretive changes that would tantamount to water quality standard changes subject to their review and approval. And I would like to know whether that is what you mean when you talk about the 2004 case decision and EPA's response.
Yes, that is what we're referring to with revising the definition of a water quality standard.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Gerald Blaha.
Yes, this is Mark Tomasek on Jerry's line. Question is on slide 16 with compliance schedules. In the Florida water quality standards for nutrients, which EPA put together, there was discussion about restoration standards. And I'm wondering if restoration standards are off the table and compliance schedules, as envisioned in the revision, are to take their place.
Okay, Manjali.
This is Manjali. What restoration standards and compliance schedules were actually, to some extent, independent thoughts. And what we're talking about here on slide 16 is really about the compliance schedule authorizing provisions, which in the Florida rule, we were clear that Florida itself has their own compliance schedule authorizing provision. The concept of restoration water quality standards, what we do with that after proposal, we're still evaluating comments and deciding how to move forward on it. But the concepts of a restoration water quality standards are very similar to the concepts of variances. And so in terms of what you're seeing here in the link, many of the principles and thoughts would probably fall under whatever we decide to do through any changes to the variances in the regulations.
And do you expect that it will talk about the length of time that compliance schedules can be listed for?
No, again, this is where compliance schedules and variances are different. We would talk about length of time for variances, but as Christina had mentioned, with compliance schedules themselves, those are actual permitting provisions. So our regulation is only going to address the relevant portion of compliance schedules which has to do with water quality standards, which is merely the authorizing provision. Any restrictions or regulations or requirements related to the permit compliance schedules themselves are really contained in the permitting program regulations, which is not subject to change in our action here.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Annette for Liberty.
My question is also regards the compliance schedule. What EPA is considering is to require the state to include in their water quality standard regulation the provisions to establish regarding the process used by the state in approving the compliance plan, or what EPA intention is to require the submittal of each compliance schedule to EPA.
This is Manjali again. What we are contemplating saying is that where a state wishes to authorize itself to be able to grant compliance schedules in its permit, somewhere in a binding regulation, such as the water quality standards or its other implementing regulations, it has to provide some sort of an authorizing provision. And while that authorizing provision doesn't necessarily have to be in their water quality standards program, it would need to have EPA approval under the water quality standards program as an effective water quality standard. So the way our programs work is that, you know, states will often have, you know, states and territories have water quality standards, but that those regulations, but regulations outside of the water quality standards can also be approved by us as water quality standards. So states will still have the discretion, and territories have the discretion of where they put the authorizing provision. It just means that EPA needs to approve it under the Clean Water Act 303C program.
Your next question comes from Ann Cohen.
Hello, this is Ann Cohen. I wanted to, some of this has already been talked about, and I guess I need a little more clarification. The water quality highest attainable use information. If I understood you correctly, you say that you will not be publishing a hierarchy that recreation is higher than fish propagation. My question is this. What if a state has additional designated uses? How would that fit into this?
You mean as if the state had maybe subcategories of a use?
Yes. For example, nutrient-sensitive waters, potential water supply.
This is Munjali. The concept of high attainable use is really referring to the spectrum within one set of uses, whether it's related to aquatic life or, you know, recreation. So, you know, it wouldn't necessarily talk about the differences between different designated uses unless there are multiple designated uses, you know, for aquatic life, you know, let's say. Our regulations say that that states need to protect for the most sensitive use in the, you know, in the suite of uses that are adopted in the standards.
So if I have a state that has a aquatic use standard for shellfish, endangered species, versus aquatic use standard for fish propagation, you're saying that that would be a hierarchy?
So shellfish is a little harder because some states have shellfish sort of protected separately from the regular aquatic life, but I think in theory, right, in theory, if it's all related to aquatic life, yes, there would be probably a hierarchy. But the idea, also to be clear, is that we will not be establishing any sort of list of hierarchical uses in the rule or the preamble. We are only going to be saying that the states must evaluate what is the highest attainable use that is attainable.
When you review water quality standards submitted by the states, will you expect them to designate the hierarchy?
Not the hierarchy, but to reflect that they have evaluated what is the highest attainable use.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from Art O'Brien.
Yes, my question relates to slide 15 on the triennial reviews. I was wondering if you could clarify if the current regulation or the possible changes require states or tribes to actually implement the recommendations that come out of a triennial review?
We actually got a similar comment on Tuesday during the public session, meaning that we got the comment about, you know, kind of, is EPA going to be evaluating the public or states or the states' consideration of public comments. I think that we are taking that as a comment, and we'll see where we land on it. But I don't think that's initially that it's not the intent of this provision here.
So in California, oftentimes we do the triennial reviews and come up with a long list of recommendations, but there's no requirement to go through and implement those list of recommendations.
And these are recommendations from the public on what they think your triennial review should cover?
No, they're recommendations from the state regulatory folks, the regional board of the, likely the regional board, to actually, here's what they recommend, but we often don't see an implementation of those recommendations.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Jeff Salt.
Jeff Salt in Salt Lake City. I have several questions. One regarding beneficial designated uses, will there be any opportunity to address the threshold time period in the law for establishing that beneficial use? Here in Utah, we have a situation where waterways were used for certain recreational uses, but then those uses were precluded through the 50s and 60s by industrial discharges and sewer plants, and now we're being told we can't establish the regulatory authority to bring back those beneficial uses that were precluded before the 1970s cutoff time. Another question would be whether your recommended changes would provide an opportunity to require states that only have narrative standards to force them or to encourage them to develop criteria so that those narrative standards could then evolve and have water quality standards, numeric standards applied to them. Another question would be, will your revisions provide an opportunity to refine and update and clarify the list of designated beneficial uses? For example, recreational boating is typically classified as 2B, non-contact or secondary contact activity, when in fact much of the non-motorized boating that's done in this country is primary contact, kayaking. And so can we look to this opportunity to refine those definitions? And lastly, is there an opportunity to allow in a triennial review adoption of water quality standards or modifications of water quality standards that are not tied to a problem identified in the state's 303D list, so we can go outside of the current 303D list and make recommendations and not be precluded from doing that during that triennial cycle?
Those were pretty loaded questions. Christina, can you start with the second one, maybe?
Well, I think what I was going to suggest is, you know, in the interest of time, we were hoping to move ahead to our discussion where we ask people for their comments and views. And since those were very in-depth questions, and you know, we're kind of
to their state.
Yeah, very maybe specific to some situations in your state. I think what we'll suggest is you could send those questions to us in an email to the SHPD comments email address that Grace provided, and that's identified on, I think it's slide 17.
Sure.
If you could send those questions to us, I think it'll be more efficient if we get back to you via email.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Lisa Zimba.
This is actually Kevin Stetter. I'm on Lisa's line. But I had a question regarding variances, and the question or the concern about how to use those variances and whether the focus would be on trying to look at who would be or what situations would be applicable to allow a variance, or if a variance was granted, there'd be certain requirements on the permittee to follow through with, kind of what the focus would be on variance.
I think, this is Manjali speaking, I think we are looking at trying to figure out regulatory requirements on both of those.
And we are open to any suggestions that you or anyone else on our call might have on specific things you'd like us to consider when identifying regulatory expectations for variances.
Yeah, I guess the concern is that, you know, there is some flexibility in for a variance to apply to multiple entities, let's say. You know, you can't be too restrictive of what's required, you know, but at the same time, this starts to get pretty close to basically a compliance schedule. So it's how those two, I guess, are different.
Okay. I want to use this opportunity to start to end the period of taking clarifying questions and move to taking your comments and views on the specific reg revisions.
At this time, I'd like to remind everyone, in order to state a comment, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your first question comment comes from Ben Otto.
Hi, Ben Otto again with Idaho Conservation League. First of all, we think that your move, the proposals for anti-degradation are timely and very appropriate. We definitely appreciate the EPA's work on this. We think that this is a very positive step forward in the in implementing the Clean Water Act. So the proposals so far look very good. We are highly supportive. We think they're critical to effectively enforcing the act, and urge you to move rapidly forward on that front. And also the same with triennial reviews. Essentially, I will just say we have the same position on that. But anti-degradation looks like a patchwork across the country, and I think it's good for the EPA. I think it's good for everybody that the EPA is going to put some certainty and clarity and some minimum standards on that requirement. So, again, thanks, and we support a strong effort in that regard. And that's the end of my comment. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Your next comment comes from Sally Shaver.
Yes, thank you. I'm not sure whether this is a question or a comment, maybe a little bit of both, but on the uses and attainability of those uses, I would be concerned about how swimmable is treated, and I don't know how that is now, but I would be concerned if states had to demonstrate that swimmable was not an appropriate use where depths make it impossible. Understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, we do know.
And I don't know how that's currently dealt with.
So is your comment that you'd like to see us address that as part of this rule or clarify that? Or
I would hate for us to require states to do a lot of demonstration and paperwork to show that swimmable is not a designated use when, you know, it's just not viable because of the water depths and stuff. I mean, that just seems like a waste of effort and time, and I just don't think it's worthy of a lot. I mean, it just should be clear in there, but I don't think a lot of paperwork should have to be done by the state in terms of demonstrating that that's not an appropriate use, even though I understand that that's a goal of the Clean Water Act that's been in there for a long time. But if you move to this demonstration-type approach, it sounded like to me there might be a lot more paperwork that could be unnecessary in the case of swimmable for some waters.
Thank you. That was a good comment.
Thank you.
Your next comment comes from David Peeler.
Hi, this is Dave Peeler again with People for Puget Sound in Olympia, Washington. And I wanted to echo the first commenter that I think this overall this is a really, really positive, constructive proposal, and the various portions you have here on uses, anti-degradation, variances, et cetera, I think really make a lot of sense overall. Of course, as we all know, it will be difficult to get all the details just right so that it actually accomplishes what you want to do without doing things you don't want to do. So we'll look forward to those. I did want to come back to the National Toxics Rule for a moment. I think that where you have the issue of uses not being protective and the administrator's determination in another section about things that the state needs to do to correct water quality standards, I think that would be an excellent place to start to address states that are still covered by the National Toxics Rule. I think that's extremely important that that rule be basically taken off the books by having states adopt their own criteria. The other issue that I was thinking about here in the way of a specific comment, and I think this could be tricky, is that I do believe that having more specificity about the process of the triennial review, as you indicate on slide 15, is critical. The one thing that isn't included there, at least that I didn't see it, is what happens at the end of the state's triennial review process. You know, you've said here that you're going to clarify that they must consider public input, and they must demonstrate that they got that input. But as with one of the previous commenters, I think, where is it that the state actually makes a determination about what it then is going to do with that information and why or why not it's going to proceed, you know, with certain changes or additions to its standards? In states, for the most part, I think, well, I won't generalize here. I think it's a difficult step for states, and I know that they don't want to have yet one more decision point that could be appealable, so I don't think I really want to push it that far, but I do think there needs to be a very straightforward sort of a determination made by the state that then is forwarded to EPA. The other thing I would say here is that my experience tells me that states are really not on a three-year schedule here, and probably haven't been for a number of years. And so there doesn't seem to be anything sort of built in currently into the rule that sort of pushes states to really want to keep up with a more current type of scheduling for the triennial reviews.
Thank you.
Your next comment comes from Shannon Filaricki.
Yes, my question is, here in Michigan, we seem to have some confusion as to how some of the EPA regulations get enforced or carried out through the local municipalities. We have cities, villages, and townships, and townships are oftentimes being asked to regulate things that they have no control or authority over. They don't maintain roads. They don't have storm sewer systems. Those are all typically handled through a county drain commission or a road commission. I'd like to see some clarification in the rules and regulations as to how to address those communities that don't have authority over the waters and what can actually be expected from them.
Thank you.
Your next comment comes from Catherine Bear.
Yeah, hi, this is Catherine Bear from American Rivers. And also would like to echo the other comments that we think this is a positive step on many of the components that EPA is proposing today. And although there's a wide range of issues that have been discussed, I wanted to focus my comments today on Tier 3 policy under anti-degradation. And we feel that Tier 3 waters represent a key part of the Clean Waters Act's water quality standards, and one that should really be better utilized to protect some of our highest quality waters. I think the federal policy in this area remains too vague and really needs to be improved to provide a better impetus for states to designate and protect Tier 3 waters. As you know, in many cases, these Tier 3 designations are either not used or poorly defined and underutilized. This really represents a missed opportunity to protect some of our high-quality and healthy waters. And it was just interesting to note that in EPA's recently released Coming Together for Clean Water Strategy, protection of high-quality waters is actually listed as a priority. So this is a great opportunity to bring those things together. In an analysis done for American Rivers, we found that across the country, only 27 states even have waters designated as Tier 3. And some of those 27 states only, some of those states only have one or two waters designated, showing really we're not doing a great job of using Tier 3 to fully protect our outstanding and healthy waters. So we recommend that we look at some of the best examples around the country as a way to possibly inform federal regulations and how to define and provide implementation guidance and requirements for states. So some states around the country, the ones that had a well-written policy that really expanded on the minimal guidance provided in federal policy, these policies often included some of the following. Some states automatically designate waters within federal and state protected lands, such as federal wild and scenic rivers that don't necessarily get clean water protections upon designation. Many states also define degradation as part of the Tier 3 policy. They define degradation as more than just an expanded point source pollution, but recognizing that flow alteration and non-point source pollution are also sources of degradation. In accordance with the federal definition, some states also designate ecologically significant waters, such as waters that provide habitat for federally listed endangered threatened species as Tier 3 waters, and that's something that really needs more emphasis to reach the Clean Water Act's goals of biological integrity. So we really hope that under this rulemaking that EPA should provide a more clear and encompassing policy to make more robust use of Tier 3 protections, including some of the things that some of the strong states are doing. This would also include an accessible public nomination process for designating waters that would include a mandatory response time, because in some states we know that people have petitioned to have Tier 3 waters, but those petitions, in fact, have just languished for several years at this point. So we support EPA's proposal to really require anti-degradation implementation adopted into state and tribal water quality standards. And would like to continue working with you to make this happen. And finally, in terms of triennial review process, we also support EPA's proposal to make this a mechanism where the public is meaningfully involved and that people should be able to petition for a change to standards and ensure that states actually conduct these reviews on the three-year schedule. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Those are very helpful comments.
Again, if you'd like to make a comment, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your next comment comes from Mary Ware.
Hello, this is Mary Ware from Memphis, Tennessee. And I wanted to know what provisions under degradation would cover coal ash storage, which is always close to rivers. And you know what happened in East Tennessee. But I don't know if any of this is covered now.
That is a very interesting question, and we're all kind of looking at each other.
Could you clarify what, restate the question?
Yeah, maybe you could tell us a little bit more briefly about coal ash storage. I don't know if we're that familiar with.
Coal power plants have to store the coal ash that is left over, and they frequently do it in these large reservoirs that's right next to the rivers that they use for cooling. And we had a terrible disaster in East Tennessee, which ruined hundreds of miles of river there. But all of our coal power plants have these coal ash, some type of storage facility that can potentially pollute all of our waters, like here in Memphis on the Mississippi River going all the way down. What provisions do you have to safeguard these from polluting our waters?
Our current regulation does provide for states to adopt water quality criteria to protect designated uses. And
I don't think those are used to regulate these coal ash storage. I don't think anything regulates it beyond what just the power companies want to do.
Yeah, I guess we're a little puzzled because I'm not sure that we're prepared to answer to your question or help you in any way. If you are able to provide us with more information via email, we could help direct you to somebody who can help you more. We're not seeing a direct link between what you're the problem that you're highlighting for us and our ability to act on it as part of this action that's the subject of this call.
Okay. Can I ask one other possible question?
Please.
Have you considered doing any regional standards for areas that have multi-state problems, as in the Mississippi River dead zone and the Chesapeake Bay dead zone? There's multiple states that are involved with this that cause it.
And when you say it's the coal ash problem?
No. I'm saying the dead zone in
the lower
Mississippi River where there's no fish at all. There's also a dead zone in the Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah, I think you're asking.
And it's caused by pollution from multiple states upriver.
Yes, I think that you're asking very relevant environmental questions.
And it takes more than one state to solve it is what I'm saying, so there needs to be multiple states working on consistent standards for the whole region.
Right, and in fact, some other caller previously mentioned the draft strategy for clean water that was put out for public comment last week. In that document, the EPA proposes to dedicate a lot of resources to the Chesapeake Bay and to use that as a model for restoration of other water bodies across the nation. And so I think there's numerous activities that EPA is undertaking in this program and other programs with a goal of restoring these waters and dealing with a hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico. I guess we can provide you with information about where to go with your questions.
Okay.
But our action, this specific rulemaking here, would not be dealing with any region-specific, state-specific issue. This is looking at changing the fundamental water quality standards regulations to try to to allow states to use the regulations to drive towards maintenance and restoration efforts and with more power and more authority.
Right. Well, my only comment on that, as long as each state sets their own standards and implementation plan, then it doesn't come together to have a regional action that's required. Or at least it hasn't happened yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next comment comes from Jessica Baca.
Hey, I just wanted to, as a comment question, is if your NPDES permits will be related or will you take into consideration the class of river that these NPDES permits are, or their point sources where they're emptying into rivers, if the anti-degradation laws will take that into consideration when issuing permits?
Well, I believe currently anti-degradation needs to be considered in the issuance and renewal of NPDES permits. Our proposed rulemaking here regarding water quality standards wouldn't change that in any way. It's more looking at the content of the implementation methods and allowing EPA to have an opportunity to review those and approve them as part of water quality standards. So not sure that I'm answering your question, but we're not looking at changing anything in the permit regulations dealing with anti-degradation.
Okay, I guess I just wanted to make sure that, you know, we were not going to continue to pollute already polluted streams if there was going to be included in the anti-degradation section to further pollute an already polluted, or how that was going to be addressed, actually.
I think we get your comment. There are other efforts in the permitting arena that I think are more relevant to your comment, and we'll pass those comments, your comment along to those people.
Your next comment comes from Jennifer Hecker.
Hi, this is Jennifer Hecker from the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, and I just had a couple of questions/comments and follow-up to the ones we offered on Tuesday. One has to do with variances, and I wondered what EPA was doing to address what we're observing here in Florida with more widespread practice of not listing impaired water bodies on the 303D list based on quote-unquote natural conditions that they're exceeding state water quality standards based on quote-unquote natural pollution. And EPA guidance is very clear that even if there is, you know, a natural source, as long as there are human-identified sources or plausible sources, that it should still be listed. But our state is not doing that. So I wondered if EPA could, number one, put some defined guidance as part of this rulemaking that addresses that in any way, perhaps under the variances section, because our state is not going through any formal variance process when it does this. And so that was my first question. And the second one has to do with uses, and it was in follow-up to a comment that was earlier about swimmable. And I would just encourage EPA to consider that swimmable should not be eliminated as a use based on physical characteristics of a water body alone, such as depth, that we're really talking about having a water quality condition that's safe for primary contact. And so, you know, and rather than a literal interpretation of swimmable, I think we need to be emphasizing more the primary contact, public health and safety aspect, and make sure that things that are just shallow aren't quote-unquote unswimmable.
Thank you.
So I just wanted feedback on those two things.
Yeah, and I just maybe just in brief response, when you have an opportunity to comment on a proposal, where the place where that would appear would be in reference to highest attainable use. So you might want to kind of take a look at that whenever that's made available and see if that's sufficiently clear to you.
Okay. So do you anticipate that EPA will not be eliminating swimmable as the highest attainable use based on physical characteristics alone?
We haven't made any decisions about the extent to which we're going to be making new policy as part of this rulemaking in the context of what factors may be used to change recreational use. So far, our thinking has been limited to reinforcing the concept that if you are changing your uses and doing a UAA, that the highest attainable use that's closest to the 101A to use is what should be put in place instead.
Okay. Well, we would encourage you. It's definitely a big movement here to make the argument to downgrade swimmable fishable water bodies based on physical characteristics like locks, weirs, dams, things of that nature, as well as depth. And we would discourage EPA from moving that direction. Is there any feedback you could give us on this whole natural conditions issue?
You know, not really, honestly. I think we need to think about that, and we are taking it down as a comment that we need to really kind of consider how this – I guess we hadn't honestly looked at the connection between variances and natural sources, and I think we need to do a little research before we're able to answer in substantively.
Well, I guess my comment is just that they should have to do something in lines of going through some kind of formal variance process. They can't just ignore the requirement to list these water bodies if they're not meeting state water quality standards because they say they're natural. And in many cases, for instance, like iron, there'll be a small contribution from groundwater, and they'll just delist it or, informally just not continue to list it based on that, even though there are anthropogenic iron contributions as well. So I want to make sure that you all are aware of that, and if there's any way that you can address that and reinforce EPA guidance that those water bodies should, in fact, be listed and continue to be listed.
This is Manjoy. I just wanted to clarify one thing. I think some part of your problem may be more with the sort of how they list the waters and a little bit independent of sort of the water quality standards and the variances process. It sounds as if there is some concern over whether or not their lists are appropriately reflecting what is impaired and what is and whether their water quality standards are being attained. So, but separate from that, in relation to your variance thought, some of the thinking that we have been going through in terms of what we would add in the variances would be to clarify what are the expectations for these waters in relation to 303D decisions when a water body is indeed granted a variance or when there is a variance that's somehow applicable somewhere on the water body. We have been talking about, whether we would clarify in regulation what does that mean for 303D listings. But if the concern is that the state is not listing waters appropriately, that is probably something that would not be directly addressed through this regulation.
Well, I should clarify. They list it as not meeting standards. They just put it as, in our state, 4C, which means it's not meeting standards, but they're not moving forward with any TMDL development because they believe it to be due to natural conditions. But then they don't get a site-specific alternative criteria, and they don't go through the process of delisting. So they don't really prove their case, but they don't move forward either. It just kind of sits in purgatory. And I just was hoping you all could do, if you could address that, we would greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, and that was a good comment.
Your next comment comes from Joseph Peterson.
I'm sorry, did you say Judith Peterson?
You're on, yes, you're on.
Okay, sure, sorry, I had a hard time understanding her. Well, this is Judith Peterson. I'm with Kentucky Waterways Alliance. I'd like to echo some of the previous caller's comments. In particular, For the most part, I think that our organization very much supports most of what EPA is trying to do here, and we will be submitting written comments. I would also like to echo the commentator from Florida recently with the concern about possibly removing swimmable or other uses just based on physical characteristics of a water body. And again, just state that, you know, we interpret that as needing to meet primary contact for a variety of reasons. It could be children's contact. It could be a whole host of uses, notwithstanding the traditional definition of swimming. I'd also like, but primarily, I wanted to comment on anti-degradation. And as you may know or may not know, Kentucky has a very long history with anti-degradation implementation, including rules that are before EPA right now. I'd like to echo Catherine Baird's comments regarding Tier 3 ONRW and the need to clarify and make additional procedures and make it easier for citizens to nominate Tier 3 waters and some sort of guidance, clarifying regulations that states need to at least need to rule on any complete submissions for Tier 3 waters that are before them as a part of the triennial review process. And some of that would be, I think, included in EPA's move here to make sure that triennial reviews are complete, our complete review of water quality standards, and that citizens' comments are sought prior to determining what a state will modify as a part of the triennial review. But in particular, I wanted to comment on anti-degradation. In general, again, we very much support EPA's move here to clarify the minimum requirements and make sure that they are adopted into a state or tribe's water quality standards and that those are submitted for EPA approval and review. But what I would also like to urge EPA is not to leave the issue at just that. That is, there are other Clean Water Act permits that we believe very strongly require an anti-degradation analysis, in particular 401 water quality certifications. These should be required to undergo an anti-degradation review, and it's unclear to me whether or not that kind of review would be explicitly stated in EPA's proposed actions here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I wanna do a little bit of a wrap up, and we have two callers with comments or views pending. But I want to do the wrap up and then turn to those two so that we can wrap up on time. Communicate that if you have additional thoughts or views after the call, there's a couple ways to proceed. You can communicate those thoughts to us by email to the email address that have been provided a couple times, and I'll provide once more, which is shpdcomments, all one word, at epa.gov. Again, shpdcomments@epa.gov. Or you could write us a letter to the address shown on slide number 19. The address, for those of you that are listening only, is the addressee would be Thomas Gardner at the Office of Science and Technology. And you need to indicate where this correspondence needs to be sent to, so please include our mail code, which would be 4305 TS in Tom, and that would be EPA 1200 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C. 20460. So again, Thomas Gardner, Office of Science and Technology, the mail code is, please indicate it, 4305 T as in Tom, EPA, 1200 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20460. We will take any written comments by email or mail that you choose to submit by September 10th. This is a little different, actually, from what the slide says. The slide currently says September 3rd. We've extended that to allow for a little bit more time for you to think about this and submit your comments. But it's important for us to get those comments by then because after that time, we cannot promise that it will be considered as part of our decision-making. We are on a schedule here, obviously, and they would be most useful if they're provided to us by September 10th. And then I'll now turn back to the operator. We seem to have three comments left, but we have 7 minutes, so we'll try to cover them all. Please try to be succinct.
Your next comment comes from Mandeepa Sarkar.
Hi. I'm calling the comment that maybe relates back to the earlier comment about the anti-degradation policy implementation. My understanding is that the current anti-degradation policy does not allow for changes to state technology standards that have been incorporated into a state NPDES permit, even if those state technology treatment requirements are exceeding the federal requirements. The problem we have is there's a state technology requirement for multi-filtration that relates to drinking water purposes, but it's in the NPDES permit, and now we are looking to remove that. There wouldn't be any change to the designated use or the water quality, but it seems to be that once it's in the permit, it can't come out. Is that a proper understanding, and would the anti-degradation implementation policy possibly address that?
That's not our current understanding, unless we're interpreting your question differently. Not sure. I think that I feel like maybe just a brief answer here would not give the merit appropriate for this.
Okay.
I would encourage you to submit a question to our email address, and we can be more thoughtful in our response that way.
Okay.
Your next comment comes from Ann Cohen.
This is Ann Cohen. I represent the North Carolina Farm Bureau, and I have a tremendous amount of concerns about our land and our agricultural land, and I feel that EPA, as they're considering changes to water quality standards, need to take into account unintended consequences such as increased contaminants in biosolids that are then applied to land, or if they're taking a discharge, saying that a facility cannot discharge into a certain water, that is then land applied with consequences to the land. And I just want EPA to consider, as they're considering these water quality standards, that they're not working in a vacuum, that there is another aspect of where people live and work and have their food produced that it is very important to protect as well. And that's my comment.
Thank you.
Your next comment comes from right there.
Hello. As you know, the US EPA commissioned a study on the state of urban stormwater management in the nation, which was conducted by the National Resources Council. The study was released in 2009 and concluded dramatically, in fact, that the National Stormwater Program is in need of overhaul and recommended that US EPA implement several of its recommendations. My questions are, one, does US EPA intend to implement any of the study's recommendations? And two, if so, when will those recommendations be implemented?
I want to make sure that you're aware that EPA is undertaking a separate rulemaking for stormwater that was announced not long ago. If you'd like us to point you in the direction of a specific person that you can talk to, we will be happy to do that.
That would be helpful.
Okay. Let's send us an email, and we'll provide you with a contact.
Thank you very much.
Christina reminded me that I should mention that we will not be responding to the written comments you submit by email or mail, except that if you're, specifically asking us to put you in contact with somebody else or seeking some clarification. But the specific comments or views on the content of our reg revisions will not be responding to at this time. Because this is not our official public comment period. We'll be taking that input and factoring into our thinking and our recommendations moving forward. And it's important for you to know that both this video feed, or I'm not sure how to call it, and audio feed, thank you, as well as any comments that you provide to us in writing will become part of the public record for this action. And that public docket record is going to be available to anybody. So just be thoughtful for that reason. And with that, unless anybody else has another comment, I'd like to thank you all. This has been very helpful to us. We have a lot to think about, and welcome your feedback as well on the effectiveness of these sessions. To provide us with your input. It seems like we have one more comment, and then we'll, operator, you can wrap it up.
Your next comment comes from Jennifer Chad.
Hi, this is Jennifer Travis from Earth Justice. I know everyone's been patient here, so I'll be quick. Echoed that there are many positive steps here, and we generally support them. I'm a little concerned about Proposal B, regarding the administrator's determination that revised or new water quality standards need to be adopted by a state. That hasn't gotten a lot of attention here, and it seems incongruous to us with the other proposals because it doesn't really strengthen water quality protections. It addresses a process question, and as it's described, it's basically aimed at protecting EPA from inadvertently creating a legal duty for itself. Which is understandable. But would EPA consider, we suggest that EPA consider not only clarifying the process point, but also expanding the scope of this change to include substantive factors or guidelines that will be considered for when the administrator should make that determination that a state needs to adopt water quality standards. This all sounds very technical, but it's very crucial when a state's water quality standards are too weak to accomplish anything and need to be revised. When would EPA consider expanding this chain to include a substantive factor or guidance on that point?
I take your observation as a comment, and we'll take and think about it.
Thank
about
you.
Other ways that we can do achieve our objective.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I'm turning it back to the operator. Oh, we have one more? Do we actually have the line open until 2:30? Okay, well, we'll take one more comment from Sonja.
Your next comment comes from Sonja Bjornhansen.
Hello, my name is Sonja Bjornhansen. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm glad EPA is considering changes to water quality standards regulation. However, I don't think they really go far enough. I'd like to see EPA take more of a look at the bigger picture, and so consistent with this, I'd like to propose an approach to protecting our nation's waters from toxics. The current approach, which involves setting water quality standards for toxics on a chemical-by-chemical basis, is not effective. This is evidenced by the fact that EPA has managed to set standards for less than 1% of the chemicals in use in our economy, and I'm surprised by the silence around this. The assumption on which the current approach is based is that in order to protect water quality from toxics, we have to define safe levels of these chemicals. While this seems perfectly logical, in practice it's very difficult to do. And in any case, the chemicals for which EPA is trying to develop standards for, or should be trying to develop standards for, have already been introduced into the environment, sometimes in large quantities. The debate over how much is safe is not useful if it serves to delay action. We need to shift our focus from defining safe levels of chemicals to developing disincentives for using them when there's scientific evidence that they can cause harm, even if that evidence is not sufficiently developed for us to be able to define the level at which they may be considered safe. What might these disincentives look like? Well, one option would be to require manufacturers to provide toxicity ratings on the labels of consumer products. The rating could appear as, say, a score from 1 to 10. And coming up with these ratings need not be difficult. For consumer products that go down the drain and end up at treatment plants, it could be done using an existing regulatory tool for which EPA has already developed extensive guidance. This tool is known as whole effluent toxicity testing, or WET testing. It's currently used to evaluate the toxicity of sewage treatment plant effluent. It basically involves assessing the impact of treated effluent on the growth and survival of a select group of aquatic species. WET tests could be used to evaluate the toxicity of consumer products and the results translated into a toxicity rating to appear on the label of the product. By giving consumers a way to distinguish between more or less hazardous products, manufacturers would have a reason to reduce their toxicity, perhaps well ahead of when water quality standards may be developed for all of the chemicals they contain. Manufacturers who are already producing less toxic products would have a competitive edge. The field of green chemistry would get a boost. It costs on the order of $5,000 to run a set of WET tests on a sample of sewage effluent. This is trivial compared to what manufacturers might spend to advertise a single product. It's also modest compared to the cost of treating a single case of cancer. In fact, compared to trying to determine which of the 80,000 chemicals currently in use in our economy are safe and at what concentrations, this proposal to use whole effluent toxicity testing to evaluate the toxicity of consumer products is modest. And thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you for your thoughtful comment. Thank you. I think we're going to wrap it up again. Thank you very much. And that's it. Have a nice day.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.